The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special section headline, 2019. People to watch. In 2019, the focus will be squarely on these 12 individuals in the Greater Triangle area as they shape their organizations to match the sustained success of the past. And the actual articles begin inside the Triangle Business Journal, first with an editor's note about this section. 2018 was a remarkable year in business in the Triangle, with outside dollars pouring into the market as the region's downtowns and surrounding areas boomed. This year promises to be another one marked by growth, but how will that growth unfold, and who are the key players in this unfolding narrative? This week, Triangle Business Journal takes a look at the people driving development across the Triangle, as well as those at the helm of key cultural resources. That was written by Sugata Mukherjee. The 2019 People to Watch, featuring Cindy Eckert, Abbott Goodwin, Valerie Hillings, Zena Howard, Chidi Kumar, Devere Learman, Jay Lewis, Sean Malone, Vincent Price, Tom Sebastian, Tim Sweeney, and Jim Whitehurst. And we'll read a few of them and then come back to more at the end. First, Cindy Eckert, title, founder and CEO, company The Pink Ceiling, Sprout Pharmaceuticals. For the Triangle signature Woman in Pink, 2018 was a year of development and big returns, literally. Cindy Eckert, the Pink Ceiling founder and CEO, returned to the helm of Sprout Pharmaceutical in July after retaking the company from Valiant Pharmaceuticals, less than 2 years after it paid $1 billion for it. "The baby is back and I'm making some radical changes," Eckert said after the deal. "This has always been about getting it right for women." Eckert was referring to the company's signature drug, Addyi, A-D-D-Y-I, the only drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to treat low sexual desire disorder in women. Although sometimes referred to as female Viagra, the drug affects the brain, not blood flow. Sprout stakeholders took Valiant to court just a year after the acquisition, alleging the pharmaceutical giant failed to develop and commercialize Addyi. The lawsuit also said Valiant hiked the drug's price to $800, well above the planned $400 price point. Valiant ultimately agreed to sell Sprout back to the shareholders for a 6% royalty on global sales. Valiant also provided a $25 million loan for initial operating expenses. With Eckert back at the helm, Addyi has officially relaunched. Women will pay as little as $25 per month for Addyi, and pay no more than $99 a month if their insurance doesn't cover the drug. In addition to working with Sprout, Eckert has continued her work at the Pink Ceiling, which she refers to as a business pinkubator. During 2018, Pink Ceiling companies and founders showed up on lists such as Time Magazine's 50 Best Inventions, which included Lia, the world's first biodegradable, paper-based pregnancy test, Fast Company's World-Changing Ideas, and Forbes 30 Under 30, among others. Eckert expects big things in the year ahead. She says the things to look out for are more personalized, accessible medical care, as well as more companies diving into the burgeoning women's health market. Filed under About Damn Time, women's health is finally receiving the attention it has long deserved, Eckert says. Investors are starting to recognize that products which address problems for half the population, never mind 85% of the decision makers in healthcare, are worth betting on. She's particularly interested in telemedicine as consumers become increasingly accustomed to the convenience and privacy it affords. Additionally, Eckert says companies using artificial intelligence to tap into a wealth of personal data to create personalized preventative care is a huge market for the future of medicine. One Pink Ceiling company, U-Method, is already doing this for patients at risk for Alzheimer's. "I'd call 2018 the Pink Ceiling's year of groundwork," she says. "2019 will be our year of launches. There's much to look forward to." That was written by Seth Gulledge. And included with these articles is a box with a closer look as the headline on it. Name, Cindy Eckert, formerly Cindy Whitehead. Prior experience, Merck, Dura Pharmaceuticals, and Elan Pharmaceutical. The number to know, $1 billion, the amount Valeant Pharmaceuticals agreed to pay for Adeyee. Next, we have Tim Sweeney, founder and CEO, company Epic Games. For Tim Sweeney, 2018 was a year of fighting, and not just because the 48-year-old founder and CEO of Kerry-based Epic Games happens to be riding a giant wave of success from its battle royale game, Fortnite. Sweeney has fought to protect his company's intellectual property and shake up the online marketplace for gamers, all while expanding the company's campus and growing revenue, and it's paying off. In October, the company scored $1.3 billion from seven high-profile investors, including KKR and Vulcan Capital. The company already counts Tencent, Disney, and Endeavor as minority shareholders. The Wall Street Journal reported at the time that the investment skyrocketed the company's valuation to $15 billion. TechCrunch, citing unnamed sources, recently reported that Fortnite grossed $3 billion in 2018 profits. Sweeney's net worth clocks in at $1.8 billion, according to Forbes. Epic Games, which moved to Cary in 1999, is the largest video game developer in the Triangle. In 2017, the company reported a local headcount of 300, more than double the size of the next largest company in the industry, and employs an additional 200 company-wide. And in August, the company filed plans for a new three-story, 93,000-square-foot building with a two-story bridge connecting to its current building at 640 Crossroads Boulevard. But getting to this point hasn't come without its challenges. Fortnite launched in September 2017, and by November 2018, its user count topped 200 million, according to industry publication PC Games N. Along the way, the company has been in a slew of legal battles to protect the game's intellectual property. Just weeks after the game was released, it filed four federal lawsuits against coders who it claimed developed software cheats to give them advantages over other players. The company followed by lobbing more lawsuits against alleged cheaters and then accused a contractor of leaking updates. Fortnite's success has also prompted a new opportunity for the company as a result of challenging Google. Epic Games opted not to include Fortnite in the Google Play Store, instead allowing Android users to install the game directly from its website. That has afforded Epic Games a chance to skirt Google's 30% tax on developers from all money made on the app. The company still lists its game in Apple's App Store under the same tax breakdown. The 30% store tax is a high cost in a world where game developers 70% must cover all the cost of developing, operating, and supporting their games, Sweeney said in an email to Business Insider. In December, the company launched the Epic Games Store, which lists PC and Mac games and only takes a 12% cut from developer sales. Sweeney founded Epic Games in 1991. In addition to other popular games, including Gears of War, which it sold to Microsoft in 2014, the company also developed Unreal Engine, a platform of tools for video game developers, and kicks a 5% royalty to Epic Games. This article was written by Mark DeRoberts. A closer look, net worth, $1.8 billion, hometown, Potomac, Maryland. Fun fact, Sweeney purchased 7,000 acres in western North Carolina for land conservation. Next is Jim Whitehurst and Ginni Rometty. Title, CEOs, companies, IBM and Red Hat. IBM CEO Ginni Rometty and Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst face a monumental task in 2019, selling not just regulators, but thousands of employees on their $34 billion combination deal. IBM, one of Research Triangle Park's largest employers, and Red Hat, headquartered in downtown Raleigh, announced the surprise deal on a Sunday in October. Within 24 hours, Rometty was in Raleigh in person, speaking at a town hall event at the Duke Performing Arts Center in downtown Raleigh, trying to convince Red Hatters that they'll keep the independence and culture they've spent years cultivating. And on a conference call, she said, "This is about resetting the entire cloud landscape. How does IBM become the undisputed leader of the world? Chapter 2 is hybrid, and we're now going to be the number one undisputed leader." While IBM and Red Hat have partnered in the past, they're very different corporations. IBM operates on a sprawling RTP campus and has been transforming its business from the inside out. a company once known for its PCs and servers, is trying to gain prowess in high-tech areas such as cloud computing. And that has come at the expense of legacy jobs, as multiple layoff rounds have been disclosed over the years, a Skills Remix executives have said. As it shifts its workspaces from the opaque walled offices of years past toward open, agile collaboration space, it has been reeling in its remote workers. Some of those unwilling to drive into a campus such as RTP every day have parted ways with the company. Red Hat, in turn, has been building an open source culture, one where the story is all about growth. Romney and Whitehurst worked to assure Red Hat employees their way of life wouldn't change. When asked at an all-hands meeting if he had anything beyond good intentions to stand on, Whitehurst responded, $34 billion for an open-source software company is kind of putting your money where your mouth is. Since that initial meeting, the company has put out multiple statements trying to alleviate the concerns of employees and customers. Cassandra Mushian, an analyst with Technology Business Research, says that's because they know that the deal depends on Red Hat keeping its culture. If that flops, then they paid a lot of money for a big mistake, she says. A proxy statement shows IBM wasn't the firm's only suitor. Several companies, not named specifically in the proxy, apparently were interested in a Red Hat acquisition. The proxy notes that in agreeing to the IBM marriage, Red Hat's board knew the timing of the deal could provide ample opportunity for additional proposals, the proxy notes, and Red Hat's other suitors have significant resources which would make them highly capable of submitting such a proposal if they so choose. Also, a handful of shareholders have filed lawsuits to stop the deal, though such litigation is typical of major transactions, and the lawsuits are unlikely to disrupt the combination. This was written by Lauren Onisorge. And in a closer look, the challenge? Combining two technology giants in the way that maintains Red Hat's open source culture. IBM, more than 366,000 employees. Red Hat, 12,600 employees. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Historic Raleigh building gets new owner, new life. After months of legwork and years of uncertainty, the historic building that houses the Sir Walter Apartments in Raleigh has a new owner, along with plans that allow the tenants to remain. Capital Realty Group of New York bought the 10-story building for $16.8 million on December 21, according to county records, after securing a low-income tax credit housing bond that will help fund renovations at the 95-year-old complex. Their hope is to pretty much complete it by the end of 2019, says Larry Jarvis, the City of Raleigh's Director of Housing and Neighborhoods. In May, the Raleigh City Council agreed to put $3 million toward Capital Realty Group's bid to acquire and renovate the building, a project that involves converting the second-floor ballroom into offices and a common area for residents. New units will be added on the 10th floor, pushing the complex's total up to 158 units from the current 140. The upgrades will total about $15 million, says John Hibbets, a broker with NAI Carroll Atlantic, who represented the prior owners in the deal. That group is managed by Salem Senior Housing and lists Bill Benton as general partner. With the new ownership, an entirely new cast of tenants will occupy the roughly 20,000 square feet of commercial spaces on the ground floor of the building, including a new business in the space of the Chick-fil-A, whose lease expired in November. The current residents at the Sir Walter qualify to live there based on age and earnings and pay just 30% of their income in rent, with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development covering the balance. Built in 1924 on Fayetteville Street, the hotel served prominent guests from across North Carolina and beyond, but as downtown Raleigh declined in the 1960s and 1970s, so did the hotel. In 1978, Benton's Group bought the property for $425,000 and converted it a year later into housing for seniors who qualified for Section 8 housing assistance payments. Franchise ownership may be flat in 2019. A franchise consultant expects the number of new owners to be flat again this year in the face of a strong economy. In 2008-2009, you can imagine we were talking to many folks, so many people had been let go, says Michael Hall, the Carolinas market leader for FranNet. We're at the opposite of that right now. You have fewer people looking to buy their own business because they're making a good income. Buying a business is a risk. Hall sees opportunities in home senior care, quick-serve restaurants, and franchises that fix exercise machines. There is no one that makes a national effort to fix these things, he says. That might be a really good business. Most admired list has some North Carolinians deeper down in the voting. People with North Carolina ties weren't at the top of the list recently when Gallup released its annual list of most admired people. Former President Barack Obama led among the men and Michelle Obama among women. Among men topping the list for those with North Carolina ties was Michael Jordan, who ranked 27th overall. That's pretty strong for someone who hasn't played basketball since 2003. He came in ahead of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who was 33rd. Jordan grew up in Wilmington, played for UNC Chapel Hill, and now owns the Charlotte Hornets. Among women, Elizabeth Dole was 21st, a slot ahead of Princess Kate. Dole is a former North Carolina senator and native of Salisbury. Pink Ceiling CEO listens, looks for candidates. Pink Ceiling CEO Cindy Eckert shared an interesting perspective on hiring in an interview with author Tim Ferriss. I do more listening than asking. I ask the one open-ended question and try to see where they will take me because I think I'm getting a lot of insights into who they are by doing that, she said. I don't think there are magical questions. I think there are ways to tease out cultural fit. I care much less about the resume. Everybody wants to come in and impress you. They haven't really hit your doorstep unless they have the cred to be in there interviewing for the position. So I think it's my job to really tease out that cultural fit so that we're both happy with each other. Co-working is on the rise. Is co-living next? Co-working is booming across the country and in the Triangle, so Biz perked up when hearing Star City, a San Francisco co-living startup, is looking to expand into San Jose, California. The concept has caught on in places such as Brooklyn, New York. Star City is asking San Jose for zoning permission to build an 18-story, 800-unit mixed-use building. There's starting to be a pretty big boom in San Jose, and we want to make sure that's not just high-end condos and expensive hotels, Star City CEO John Deshotsky told Silicon Valley Business Journal. The facility is about a mile from a new campus as being built. The concept includes a private kitchen and bathroom, but a shared common area and kitchen, in other words, dorms for adults. Chapel Hill Mall might get new life after purchase. A well-known Chapel Hill shopping center has changed hands as a Florida firm continues to invest in the Triangle. Ram Realty Advisors bought the University Place complex from Madison Marquette for $51.6 million, according to the Orange County Register of Deeds office. The 366,000-square-foot mall has added a number of shops in recent years to inject new life into the complex, but through the third quarter, 11% of its 366,000 square feet sat empty. Chapel Hill Economic Development Officer Dwight Bassett says the sale could usher in a new era. It's a great opportunity for changing and relooking at that center, he says. I think there'll be a great company helping to move it into the 21st century. Ram Realty Investments in the region include $41 million for the Pavilion East Mixed Use Center in Durham. And now in the general news section of the Triangle Business Journal, we have a story written by Ben Graham and Lauren Onasorge. Could the mystery buyer be tied to Apple? A swath of undeveloped land in Research Triangle Park that Apple had been targeting for a new campus has sold to a business entity with few details about who is behind it. The property acquisition totals 281 acres on the Wake County side of RTP and was sold in several transactions December 21 by the Research Triangle Foundation and Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund. The buyer, Acute Investments LLC, was registered in North Carolina in March with Parker Poe lobbyist R. Bruce Thompson listed in the filing. Thompson, according to the NC Secretary of State's office, has registered to lobby for Apple in the state. Thompson declined to comment on the transaction in an email. RTF CEO Scott Levitan declined to comment on the property sales or the identity of the buyer, citing a non-disclosure agreement. The foundation is tasked with managing RTP and typically sells land to companies looking to establish offices in the region. Levitan did confirm that an ancillary daycare facility had been approved for the undeveloped property that just sold. That approval came at a meeting of the Tenants and Landlords Association of RTP on December 6. The sale totals nearly $50 million and encompasses a contiguous tract of land on the north side of Lewis Stevens Drive and Little Drive, south of Cisco Systems campus on Kit Creek Road, according to Wake County records. Acute Investments bought the property in three transactions. Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund sold 123 acres to the company for more than $32 million. RTF and an affiliate business entity sold the company the balance of the land for a total of $17.5 million. As part of the deal, RTF agreed to extend the time limits it typically puts on new development in the park. The foundation agreed to give Acute Investments 10 years to begin construction on new facilities instead of 4 years, and another 4 years after that to complete construction once it begins, rather than the typical 2 years. If those timelines aren't met, the foundation can levy fines or buy back the properties, according to Wake County records. The property sales closed December 21, 8 days after Apple announced it would be opening a new $1 billion corporate campus in Austin, Texas, where it already has a sizable presence. Before the announcement, top Apple officials had been targeting property in RTP for a new campus, the same land that just sold to Acute Investments, according to multiple sources familiar with the deal. Since the new campus was announced in Austin, elected leaders and economic development officials have been vague with their comments about Apple's apparent rejection of North Carolina. In a rare joint statement the day of Apple's announcement, Governor Roy Cooper, Senator Phil Berger, and House Speaker Tim Moore lauded the economic opportunities for the state without providing details on Apple. There's no better place to find a top-tier IT workforce, and legislative leaders have worked closely with the administration to attract large employers and technology companies like Apple, the legislator stated. We'll keep doing everything we can to bring more good jobs to North Carolina. At a recent economic development forum, Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, said, "Next question," when asked what the state offered for the project. Cooper has called Apple an active recruitment opportunity for the state. Apple did not respond to a request for comment. And for related information, we'll turn to the Viewpoint page for the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "Here's the Inside Story on the Apple NC Project." Some theories have evolved as to why the Triangle was left out when Apple announced in December that it was building a new campus in Austin, Texas. Now remember, just a few months ago, Apple CEO Tim Cook had mentioned it was unlikely the new campus would be in California or in Texas because the company already had a big presence in those two states. And yet, Austin was chosen for the new campus. So, what happened? Here's my theory. Early in the year, when Apple started looking at communities, the Triangle and Northern Virginia were high on its list. As weeks passed and Cook and COO Jeff Williams made separate visits, they started talking more and more about a site in Research Triangle Park and temporary space at a Highwoods Properties building in Cary. But questions started swirling around North Carolina's botched bathroom bill fiasco from a couple of years ago. Progressive groups warned Apple management of a severe backlash if Apple selected North Carolina. Cook realizes this could be a problem, so he wants some assurance from North Carolina lawmakers and Governor Roy Cooper that divisive social issues would not be taken up by the General Assembly regardless of what local municipalities enact. While Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland is feverishly working with the offices of NC House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger to find a compromise, Apple moves forward with its North Carolina plans. Then comes the surprising move by the General Assembly to put six constitutional amendments, including voter ID laws, on the November ballot. Apple balks and wants to see what happens in the November elections. Voter ID law passes easily, and so do three other amendments. but Republicans lose supermajorities in both chambers, meaning a veto by the governor in 2019 could not be overturned by Republicans alone. Cook and his team make one last attempt to get state lawmakers to enact some law or rule that prevents them from intercepting progressive measures enacted by local communities. Apple gets no such assurance. In December, Apple names six other cities that will benefit from future expansion plans. What you just read is my theory. Without a doubt, many will disagree. But before you disagree, allow me to make these points. Why would a company agree to lease 175,000 square feet of office space in Cary and buying 200-plus acres of land in RTP if there were other communities it was considering? From our story last week, it is quite possible the Mystery LLC may still front Apple in buying the RTP land, but nothing will happen there until North Carolina lawmakers are willing to make some changes. What company spends so much time, effort, and research on a community only to completely bypass the location? If that doesn't sound like a message being sent, I don't know what is. Someday, Apple will have a presence in the Triangle, a big one, I believe. But as far as Cook is concerned, some things have to change first. And returning to the news articles in the Triangle Business Journal, SAS asks judge to dismiss harassment lawsuit. SAS Institute is firing back in court against one of its former hairdressers, a woman who alleged her supervisor sexually harassed her at the Cary headquarters campus. On December 31, SAS filed a motion to dismiss the claims Shante Morris made in federal court in June. The analytics company doesn't respond to her specific accusations in its motion. Instead, it accuses Morris of failing to state a claim in her complaint. In a memo supporting SAS's motion to dismiss, defense attorney Kevin Sedklowski of Pointer Sproul writes that, as Morris claims to have been terminated in early 2014 and filed the wrongful discharge claim in 2018, the case is beyond the scope of the statute of limitations. It goes without saying that a former employee who raises a complaint of harassment and retaliation almost 4 years after the fact and well past the applicable administrative filing deadline does not have a reasonable objective belief of a valid claim, it states. The memo also alleges that by identifying the firm as SAS Institute instead of SAS Institute Incorporated, the lawsuit failed to name the correct defendant, another reason to dismiss. And Sedklowski claims there are no allegations about what this unnamed person said in Morris's initial complaint. Morris, who filed notice last month that she will represent herself in court, didn't return a request to comment on the case. Morris styled hair as a contractor at SAS for 14 years. She filed her initial 10-page suit on June 11. That was written by Lauren Onisorge. This next article, written by Mark DeRoberts. Greg Poole Jr., developer of McGregor Downs, dies. James Gregory Poole Jr., a Raleigh businessman and developer who had a lasting impact on the city, died December 29 after a brief illness. He was 84. A Raleigh native, Poole was the president and CEO of Gregory Poole Equipment Company, which his father founded in 1951. He took over leadership of the company in 1964 and retired in 1998. He and his father developed McGregor Downs and later launched McGregor Development Company, building Lochmere and McGregor Park in Cary. Ann Poole was a driving force behind the new park that will rise on the Dorothea Dix campus. He was the head of Dix Visionaries, an advocacy group for the development of Dorothea Dix Park in downtown Raleigh, and his visitation was held at the park at the Flowers Cottage on January 1. Poole graduated from UNC Chapel Hill in 1957 and served 3 years in the Army Reserves. His is a 2013 inductee into the Raleigh Hall of Fame. Novant names Stafford new president. Written by Seth Gulledge. Leadership at Novant is shifting again, with several executives changing roles as the company shifts its strategic focus. This month, the Morrisville-based company announced several management and strategic shakeups to kick off the new year. Paula Brown Stafford, the company's former chief development officer, has been promoted to president and chief operating officer, a newly created role. She is replacing Nathan Stasko, who has stepped down as president and from his role on the board of directors. Stasko, a co-founder and former CEO of the company, will remain Novant's chief scientific officer, a position he took following the board's appointment of Kelly Martin as CEO. Stafford first joined the company in 2017 after she left her position as the president of clinical development at Quintiles. To replace Stafford as chief development officer at Novant, Elizabeth Messersmith has been promoted to the role. Messersmith first joined the company as head of clinical operations in 2017. The company also announced the promotion of Carrie Gear to senior vice president and chief technology officer, another new position at the company. Gear has been with the company for 8 years and previously worked at Merck & Company. These leadership adjustments provide Novant with a truly exceptional and experienced team, Martin said in a release announcing the changes. The combination of Paula, Carrie, and Liz in their new roles adds depth and real-world experience in several critical areas. The company also announced it plans to add gastrointestinal disease as a therapeutic focus. The company intends to initially focus its efforts on pediatric GI diseases. Now we turn to a section called Looking Back. Company's economy made tangible impressions in 2018, written by Sugata Mukherjee. Note, we identified 7 stories in our January 5, 2018 issue that we believed would come with big developments or updates during the year. Here's an update on those 7 stories and what really happened. Future of Rocky Mount Rail Hub now uncertain. Yes, it turns out no one really knows what will eventually happen to this project, but overtures from Jacksonville, Florida-based train giant CSX Corporation indicate the initial $275 million rail hub in Rocky Mount is being restructured. The company finalized plans through an agreement with North Carolina to build a smaller intermodal transportation facility across from North Carolina Wesleyan College on U.S. 301. The project, known as Carolina Connector, will receive some $118 million from the state for site development and roadway construction. Economic developers had been touting that such a transportation hub could jumpstart economic development. The project could create some 1,300 jobs. Merger of UNC Healthcare and Atrium Health Systems. Right from the start, we knew this was going to be a big deal. The deal to merge was announced in August 2017 with an intended close sometime in 2018. But the deal never materialized. Atrium Health, formerly Carolina's Healthcare, called off the deal in March, and by all accounts, it looks like the issue of control of one of the largest healthcare systems in the country could not be worked out between parties. For Dr. Bill Roper, the CEO of UNC Healthcare, bigger news would come a few months later when the UNC system appointed him its interim president following the departure of Margaret Spellings, who announced in October that she would step down. Housing supply. This topic was an easy layup for us. We knew that the housing supply would chase demand pretty much all year, and true to form, sales and home prices kept inching upward for most of the year. But not anymore. That crazy hot market cooled down by the end of the third quarter. In October, sales were down 1%. Showings were down and interest rates were starting to creep up. By November, the figures did not change that much, but Realtor.com, the trade organization, estimates home sales in Raleigh are expected to grow some 2.4%, and prices will increase almost 4% in 2019. In the Durham-Chapel Hill metro area, prices are expected to jump even more, although sales will be softer than the Raleigh metro estimates. Towns on edge of Triangle benefit from boom. Given the explosive growth around the 6 core counties known as the Raleigh-Durham area, we speculated that some outlying towns and counties would receive a welcome economic development boost because of its proximity. And we were right. Edgecombe County finalized agreements with Triangle Tire and Corning. With the two projects set to occupy more than 500 acres at the Kingsboro megasite, Triangle Tire is investing $580 million and creating 800 jobs. Corning's investment of $86 million will be creating 111 jobs. Also, Universal PreservaChem Incorporated, UPI, selected Mebane as the new location for its natural ingredients and chemical supply business, creating 39 jobs. The company plans to invest $17 million in Mebane. And Project Lego, also known as packaging firm Cascades Incorporated, picked its Scotland County tissue production site over its Canadian headquarters for a 66-job expansion. The $58 million project is expected to retain the 221 current workers, and the new jobs will pay $49,000 annually. For comparison, the average wage in Scotland County, the county seat is Laurinburg, is $35,330. Volatile economy. This time last year, based on the consensus from various economists, we predicted the U.S. economy would grow about 2.5% in 2018. It looks like the economy will grow by about 3%. After an amazing GDP growth of 4.2% during the April-June quarter, the economy cooled down to 3.4% in July through September quarter, and the October-December quarter is expected to do between 2.5% and 2.8%. As predicted, inflation and interest rates are at the forefront of Federal Reserve's monetary policy. That policy will be under microscope in 2019, as many predict a potential showdown in the second half of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 23,346 on January 2, 2018. On December 31, it closed at 23,327. Restaurant scene heats up. With the local economy booming, it did not require a rocket scientist to predict the restaurant scene would expand in 2018. And it did. Restaurants such as A Place at the Table on Harget Street got some national attention from NBC with its Pay What You Can concept. Food halls popped up across the Triangle, including the opening of the Morgan Street Food Hall and the expansion of Chapel Hill's Blue Dogwood Public Market. And the Durham Food Hall is expected to open this year near the Durham Farmers Market. However, there were some casualties during the year. Durham chef Scott Howell closed Nana's Eatery after 26 years, and pitmaster Keith Allen closed Allen & Son Barbecue Restaurant in Chapel Hill, among others. Capitol Boulevard changes. Dramatic changes are underway as two developers with deep ties to Raleigh, John Kane of Kane Realty, and Cross Williams of Williams Realty and Building Company, develop a mixed-use project at Peace and West Streets. The project comes as the major road changes are underway. With the dismantling of an aging bridge, the project meant the loss of Finch's Diner and others, but will bring a 12-story mixed-use project with a Publix grocery store. Completion is expected in 2020. A second phase of the development with another office tower breaks ground this summer. What is not rising is a Major League Soccer stadium. The city still has hopes for an expansion franchise in the future, but there are no firm plans yet to build a proposed stadium in the area. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Smalls Business section to read the column written by Jim Verdonik, who is the author of Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment and Platform Regulation. The headline, New Avenues Open for Those Who Are Willing to Be Bold. I really like January. While the weather makes many dream of Caribbean vacations, I love knowing I haven't made any big mistakes this year. Even my wife says I haven't screwed up since 2018. She's not optimistic I can keep this going, but every year brings new hope. Starting with a clean slate is a relief, but the key is creating new things. But the key to creating new things is taking risks and learning from mistakes. We rarely get things right the first time. Successful people are better at not giving up when things go wrong and turning those lessons into better decisions. In the capital raising business, new laws and new technology have allowed us to create new strategies. Changes and mistakes go together like gin and tonic, but so do change and success. To face these challenges, we're helping investors find the right mix of new and old practices. We are inventing new types of securities, for example, minimizing dilution by selling revenue share notes instead of equity. Founders and investors are deferring taxes by reinvesting profits after successful ventures and qualified opportunity funds created by the change in tax laws in 2017. Social impact investors and entrepreneurs are combining their pursuit of profit with their desire to solve social problems. Investors are using crowdfunding to create diversified portfolios by investing small amounts of money in a wide range of businesses. All these new practices create a mix of successes and failures. Each time we use a new tool, we produce better results. The key is understanding what we did wrong and to avoid repeating the same mistake. So, what are the things we can learn as we use these new investment tools? Free money and free lunches are illusions. Diversification is still important. It takes money to make money. Rules about what you have to do to sell securities didn't disappear with cryptocurrency and tokens. I'm looking forward to 2019 as we learn how to succeed by taking risks and learning from our mistakes. What about you? Returning to the Viewpoint page, we'll read The Real Value of Economic Studies. This column is written by Ray Cortado, who is a senior economist and resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Question 1. When are special interest subsidies not special interest subsidies? Answer, when the special interests hire consultants to do an economic impact study. Question 2. How often do economic impact studies show that the special interest subsidy will be good for the economy? Answer, always. Economic impact studies have become part of the standard toolkit used by nearly every special interest pleader begging state and local officials to please, please, please transfer wealth from workers, entrepreneurs, and taxpayers to themselves. The film industry, sports teams, the renewable energy industry, and many other corporate welfare recipients pay consultants to tell them not only what they want to hear, but more important, what they want the public to hear, namely how great the subsidies will be for those who are being fleeced. Sure, those film incentives or subsidies for a new football stadium are going to make the film industry or the NFL team owners a lot of money, but pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. What these industries really care about is that they are going to make all of you out there in the community better off. And to prove this, everyone from local politicians to the local media is told to look at those impressive numbers from the industry-paid economic impact study. Thousands of jobs will be created and hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of dollars will be generated for the community. It's the proverbial win-win. The beauty of an economic impact study is how it demonstrates that Peter can be robbed to pay Paul, and magically, both Paul and Peter are made better off. So here's the dirty little secret about economic impact studies. They are designed so they can only give one kind of result, positive. The possibility that any subsidy or special project could generate negative results for the economy, i.e. lose jobs, reduce incomes, or shrink GDP, is ruled out by design. I have explained why in several other publications, but the longer arguments that I've made elsewhere can be boiled down to one simple point. The studies all assume none of the resources being used, labor, land, steel, electricity, etc., would be employed in any other productive activities if the subsidized companies or industries weren't using them. If a 10-acre plot weren't being used for a subsidized solar power plant, it wouldn't be used to grow soybeans or sweet potatoes. It would just be lying there idle. And if the workers used to install the solar panels weren't hired to do that job, they would be in the unemployment lines. These are the kinds of assumptions that are implicit in constructing the studies meant to convince the public that these subsidies are really for their own good. There are no job losses, no wage reductions, and no GDP losses to calculate and subtract from the gains. So the question that all these studies are asking is, how good will the special interest subsidy be for the economy? Not whether it will be good or bad. The answer to this question comes through all of the ripple effects from the subsidy, sometimes called multiplier or secondary effects. This has to do with how the subsidies work their way through the economy once they're handed over to the special interest. Again, all of these effects are assumed to be positive for the same reason as discussed above. None of the resources being used would be employed in any other productive activity if it weren't for the subsidy. How large the total impact ends up being has everything to do with these rippling effects. Often they are assumed to be 10, 15, or even 20 times the amount of the original subsidy. The bigger the ripple effect, the better off the special interest subsidies are making everyone. The numbers the typical economic impact study generates have no meaningful economic content. They cannot intelligently inform debates over whether any particular project or subsidy would be worthwhile. As a general rule, the public and politicians should never view economic impact studies as anything more than an attempt by special interests to manipulate public opinion for their own benefit. And with our remaining time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read more of the 2019 People to Watch article. The next one is Abbott Goodwin, title Partner, Company, Columbia Development. This is written by Ben Graham. Columbia Development partner Abbott Goodwin began 2018 by shepherding his company's Fenton mixed-use project in Cary through a crucial rezoning approval from the town. In October, Goodwin scored another win for the 2.5 million square foot community when the town agreed to spend nearly $30 million to help offset the cost of the project. Combined, those two milestones have set up Goodwin and Columbia Development to begin work in 2019 on the project that is supposed to reshape the Eastern Gateway into Cary. It was impossible to go to debt and equity without the approval of the incentive package from Cary, he says. That had to come first. It was a big missing piece of the puzzle. Goodwin will now guide the project through the development process. That means locking down new shops and restaurants to populate the development, even as he closes on a deal to buy the 92-acre property from the state and breaks ground on the first phase. Goodwin will be navigating that maze as construction costs continue to rise across the triangle and uncertainty lingers at Cary Town Center across the street. Citing a strategy shift, IKEA backed out of plans to open a store at the struggling mall last year, and now the mall's owner, CBL & Associates Properties, is looking to sell. Goodwin won't say how uncertainty at the mall might affect his firm's plans, but any hopes of revitalization along Cary's Eastern Gateway are, for now, in the hands of Goodwin and Columbia Development, a privately held firm based in Columbia, South Carolina. In 2017, Cary leaders visited the Avalon development in Alpharetta, Georgia, to get a vision of what Fenton will look like when complete, but Columbia Development has yet to release specific plans on the first phase. Goodwin anticipates providing those details in the beginning of 2019 and breaking ground by the second quarter. When complete, the project could include as much as 1.2 million square feet of office and 570,000 square feet of retail space, in addition to hundreds of apartments and hotel rooms. Wegmans has already signed on as an anchor tenant with a 125,000 square foot grocery store. Goodwin describes the overall project as the most complicated of his career. If you asked anyone who's involved with it, they might say the same thing, he says. Over the next 12 months, the investment dollars will start to pour in as dirt begins to move, and Goodwin will be tasked with steering the ship. Next is an article written by Dane Huffman concerning Valerie Hillings, titled Director Company, North Carolina Museum of Art. When Valerie Hillings was a student at Duke University, she visited the North Carolina Museum of Art and marveled at the bright, sprawling work by Frank Stella called Rockatoo. After graduating in 1993, her career led her to New York City, where she worked for the Guggenheim Museum and Foundation for 14 years. And then it brought her back. On October 1, NCMA announced that Hillings would replace the retiring Larry Wheeler. She took over November 1, and like any new employee, has had to learn to master the nuances of a new job, such as the phone system. But her biggest challenge will be sustaining the momentum Wheeler built in his 24 years at the museum. He also used his ebullient personality and keen sense of art to build support for a bright new building, an outdoor pavilion, and an art-dabbled park where a youth prison had been. The museum's budget is now $24 million, of which only 35% comes from state funding. I know the museum under Larry grew quite a lot and became successful, says Hillings, adding that she has enjoyed conversations with the staff and donors that have helped her better understand the museum's history. So now the question is, what's next? In 2019, the museum will develop a 5-year strategic plan. The questions, she says, include, who is the NCMA? How are we working? What are we excited about? What, through the lens of art, are we trying to do? What is our role in the community? Hillings is working with the staff to assess the collection and see how any gaps can be filled. This is a survey museum that offers a look across a long period of time, she says, so it'd be my goal for us to think really carefully about what are our opportunities and our strengths and how we address those across the collection. She wants to continue having the strong exhibitions that were a hallmark of Wheeler's era and seeks a balanced calendar that includes both crowd pleasers and exhibitions that might be less expected. Hillings also wants to see what the museum can do to highlight the work of the North Carolina artists. In addition, she also wants to consider ways to display the current collection in new and thought-provoking ways similar to what the Tate Modern does in London. It doesn't necessarily have the most world-class collection. It has great things, but they have taken what they have and have used it in exciting ways, Hillings says. She says her friends in the art world knew she loved North Carolina, and many are really shocked by what's here at NCMA, including three John Singleton Copley paintings. It was really thrilling to see everybody so surprised, Hillings says. She wasn't, after all. She'd marveled at the collection years ago. And Mark DeRoberts wrote the next article concerning Zena Howard, title Managing Director, North Carolina Practice, Company, Perkins & Will. As the calendar flips to 2019, it will be running toward 2 years since Zena Howard took over as Managing Director of North Carolina Operations for global architecture firm Perkins & Will, replacing Phil Freelon, one of the biggest local names in the industry. Freelon, who stepped down in May 2017 after announcing he has ALS, has praised Howard for her leadership ability, commitment to client satisfaction, and professionalism. Howard, a North Carolina native and a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Architecture, joined the Freelon Group in 2003, more than a decade before the firm was folded into the Perkins & Will banner. She has held leadership roles on high-profile projects throughout the state and country, most notably as senior project manager for the Smithsonian Institute's $540 million National Museum of African American History and Culture on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Her portfolio of projects includes the Durham County Human Services Complex, the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro, the Anacostia and Tenley Friendship Libraries, both in Washington, D.C., the Motown Museum in Detroit, and Brooklyn Village in Charlotte. Howard also enjoys serving as a mentor. That's reflected in a high industry honor she received in March when she was elevated to the American Institute of Architects College of Fellows, a distinction only 3% of AIA members have earned. Howard is also an associate professor at the NC State University College of Design. As an African-American woman working in a field historically dominated by men, Howard sees an obligation to be a role model, particularly for underrepresented persons in this profession. However, I don't consider this pressure, rather more of a duty and an honor. The advice I would give to other aspiring young architects, is to stay committed to this profession, which can often seem difficult. Associate yourselves with work that is meaningful and strengthens our communities. Value the process of creating and the relationships that are built throughout. As managing director, she moved the office in 2017 from the Research Triangle Park area to the iconic landmark downtown tower, a 53-year-old building in downtown Durham built for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, the historic African-American-owned financial services company. At the time of the move, Howard noted that the practice is known for our projects celebrating stories of African-American culture, history, and perseverance. Continuing this work in the North Carolina Mutual Building offers us added inspiration as designers and storytellers. In 2018, Perkins & Will ranked as the fifth largest architecture firm in the state based on the number of registered architects, of which it has 33 between its Durham and Charlotte offices. The next article, written by Lauren Onisorge, concerns Devere Learman, title Associate Vice President, Delivery Head, Company, Infosys. Indian IT firm Infosys has bullish plans for the Triangle to build out a new 2,000-job technology hub in Raleigh's Briar Creek. At the center of the plan is Devir Learman, the leader, tapped to helm the Triangle operation. Learman is a well-known name in the Triangle, a longtime veteran of IBM, where she led large global engineering teams. The Cary resident has been tasked with building the strategy, vision, operations, and culture of this newly created innovation hub, according to her LinkedIn profile. What excites me most about joining Infosys isn't just the chance to work with some of the area's renowned companies or even building an operation from the ground up, she wrote in an August blog post. Rather, it's the opportunity to have a real impact on the Raleigh community by cultivating the workforce of tomorrow right here at home. And expectations are high. Infosys CEO Salil Parekh came to Raleigh to communicate that over the summer, calling the operation critical to the global operation. It's a massive operation for us, he said, noting that the office could potentially grow bigger than the 2,000 job target. My sense is the demand we see from our clients is so massive that it would be great to see us do more, he said. It's not that there's a limit. If we see more demand and we are able to build a more skilled workforce, we think we can do more. In North Carolina, Infosys could be in line for a performance-based jobs development investment grant worth up to $22.3 million if it meets its milestone. The company is in line to receive an additional $3 million from North Carolina Community Colleges. The ramp-up in Raleigh is part of a pledge to add 10,000 U.S. workers in the next few years. Already, the team is growing faster than anticipated. When Infosys cut the ribbon on its two floors at its Briar Creek building in August, it already had about 500 employees at the site. And Ravi Kumar, president and deputy chief operating officer, speculated one day opening a full campus in the region. Amid all that growth, Learman will be tasked with maintaining the culture Infosys is trying to create. A big part of that culture involves training. Infosys makes significant investments in its new hires, pushing them into boot camp-style programs catered to what they'll soon be doing at its campuses. But it's a risky investment, as Kumar admits, that if Infosys can't retain the talent, then it is training a workforce for someone else. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.